Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of Epic. I'm joined by Scott Greeson of the Friends of the Eel River. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom.
Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center.
Hey, Tom.
And we're joined by, can I say best-selling, fantastic,
those words are okay. I'm good with those.
Fantastic best-selling author, Becky Local. Chambers. Local.
Yeah.
Another good word to throw in there. Author, Becky Chambers. Hey, Becky.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining the Eco News Report. And so this is kind of an interesting issue of the Eco News Report.
We've done poets. We've done historians.
I guess that's true.
You know, look back, look around, look forward.
We're expanding into science fiction and what perhaps lessons.
It is the literature of our time.
Yeah. What lessons that science fiction can have for us moving forward.
There's that. And it's also very soothing to those of us that have to face reality all the time to think outside the box a little bit.
And Becky has a fantastic reputation of as being an optimistic science fiction writer and not one of those depressing
dystopian
types. So maybe we'll gain some inspiration moving forward too. So Becky is the author of The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, A Closed and Common Orbit, Record of a Spaceborne Few, and To Be Taught, If Fortunate. So thank you, Becky, for joining the show.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
The first thing we ought to mention, just to keep the, you know, sort of limelight bright, is that you started this series, the Wayfarer series, as it's known, with a Kickstarter project.
I did, yes.
You were self-publishing, and you wound up last year, 2019, with the Hugo Award for the best series. So, you know, first off, congratulations.
Thank you.
And also, what the heck? How on earth?
I have no idea. I don't know. I'm still pinching myself over it. It really has been an incredible journey from start to finish. And I'm just incredibly grateful for where it is now and excited to see where it goes in the future.
Honestly, I hadn't realized you won the Hugo last year. I think I would have been more reluctant to ask you to come up.
if it's any consolation, my socks don't match right now. And I definitely broke a glass this morning. So I assure you we're mortal.
That's a millennial star thing, though, isn't it? Unmatching socks,
You know.
I think it's more of a laundry thing in my case.
So in case you're not aware, the Hugo Award is for the best science fiction book of the year.
Yeah, and it's given by science fiction fans. It's really, you know, it's a really wholesome kind of award in a lot of ways. I mean, it's just like it says we love this to me.
And you've joined an incredible list of other award winners, including my favorite, Kurt Vonnegut. Multiple Hugo Award winner, Philip K. Dick, and other icons of the science fiction genre.
Yeah, and we won't spend a lot of time on the fact that you beat out Charles Stross's Laundry Files, which is another great, great series. I love that.
Even though it is, you know, I suppose competitive, I don't see it that way. It's such a cliche to say it was an honor to be nominated, but really, I mean, everybody who was on the ballot last year was incredible. So it was amazing company to be in.
Let's go back to this sort of idea about attitude, about your optimism. One of my favorite political commentators says that optimism is not actually a judgment about the future. It's a moral stance about how we live in the world. But you write from a world where, frankly, you know, we get up in the morning and we look at Twitter and it's a dystopian science fiction film, a really bad one, you know, and yet you come up with these stories about family, about hope, about finding yourself. Did you do that on purpose or did it just come out that way?
Absolutely on purpose. I think one of the key things to remember with science fiction is it's never actually about the future. It's always about now, right? Most of us are not writing to be soothsayers or prophets or whatever. We're writing our feelings about the here and now. And so I think it makes a lot of sense that a lot of the sci-fi, not universally, but a lot of the sci-fi we're seeing in recent years is more dystopian or grimdark because we're scared. The future is scary. I log on in the morning too, and it freaks me out. And so I think that's healthy to sort of exorcise our fears that way. It'd be like, we're going to write these cautionary tales. We're going to, you know, get these feelings out. But I think if that's all you have, reality itself is challenging enough, and we as a species are facing problems on this planet we've never had to face before, at least we've never been aware of right. to the degree that we are now. And I think if all we feed ourselves is dystopia and grimdark, I think that throws us out of balance, right? That just sort of breeds nihilism. And I say that with a lot of love for the darker stories out there. You know, I read that stuff too, and I love it, but I think there has to be a counterbalance.
And not just princess stories.
Exactly. Yeah. I really try to do that with my work, to have something on the other side of saying, yeah, things are hard right now. They're probably going to get harder, but here's what it could be. A lot of the Wayfarer series in particular is sort of post-dystopian, right? The human species has had to leave Earth because we broke it. But that's ancient history at this point.
It's post-apocalyptic, but you don't tell us about the apocalypse.
I don't talk about the apocalypse. I talk about what was worth the struggle. Right. You know, here's the life at the end of it that made that struggle worth it. And I think having that sort of thing to point your compass to is very important, because if all you're imagining is here's how bad the future could be, and you're never thinking about, well, here's how good it could be, here's what it would look like if everything turned out right, you know, that just kind of paralyzes you.
One of the things, as I think back about all the space opera I've grown up with, that, you know, is a sort of common theme, joking a little bit, as I just did, about princess stories. But, like, you look at Star Wars, and it's a prince and princess story. You know, all those people are always extraordinary heroes. You don't write like that. You're writing about something different. You say it's about every man, every woman in space. Again, this seems like a choice you made. Why?
Yeah, this too is very intentional. So you've permitted me to get on my soapbox here for a second. So my thing is that I feel like there's a fundamental problem in the way we tell stories about space. And I say this as someone who has, you know, I've been embedded in space opera my entire life, and I grew up in a family very heavily involved in space science and very pro space exploration in general. So that's where I'm coming from with all of this. And if you look at both the parallel between the fictional stories we tell about space and the reality of what human spaceflight has been here on Earth, the stories we tell, you're absolutely right, are chosen one narratives. They're always about, you know, the hero, be it a military hero or a rebel hero. Even if you're talking a scrappy underdog, say your Han Solos or your Malcolm Reynolds, John Crichtons, like they're still somebody who at the end of the day is going to save the solar system or the galaxy or whatever.
Or they discover that their secret power,
they're secretly great for some reason. Right. They're the one who comes in and saves the day. Right. So it's always about these very exceptional people. And for good reason. There's a reason we tell stories like that, because they're fun and they're exciting.
And they crystallize something in the larger culture.
Exactly.
Grendel was no ordinary Viking. Yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And then, so you flip over and you look at the real world then, you know, going back to the space race, the Apollo era, everybody who's going to space is the military elite, right? Test pilots, the guys with the right stuff, you know, the best of the best. Nowadays, the shuttle era onward, you're talking about a different sort of astronaut. Then you start looking at the intellectual elite, right? People with very advanced degrees.
Two or three of them.
Right, two or three. You know, you look at resumes of astronauts and they're just monumentally impressive, you know, and it's a very, very select group.
But, fighter jocks and scientists.
Right. Yeah. You know, only a very small fraction of people who apply for the astronaut corps actually get in. And now with the advent of private space flight, you're starting to get the economic elite. Right. The people who can buy their way into space, or the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses of the world, people who can just put down a deposit for Virgin Galactic, et cetera.
4 hours of zero G for $15 million. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so there's this in both spheres. Space only belongs to the elite, right? The universe only belongs to the very, very few. And to me, that couldn't be further from the truth, because space belongs to all of us equally. We are all stardust and we all belong to this universe equally. It should be accessible to us and we should feel a sense of belonging there. When we hear about people going to space, we shouldn't look at it as this sort of out of reach thing. We should see it as something we could all do, a place we could all go. And so with the Wayfarer books in particular, what I did is I built a very typical space opera setting. You have these intergalactic species and border wars and big politics and all of this stuff going on. But all of that is sort of happening in the very, very background on the nightly news or what have you. It's not the things that's actually directly impacting these people's lives. The characters in these books largely tend to be working to middle class people, or what would be the equivalent thereof, who are just sort of worried about what they're going to have for dinner and their families and their jobs and the things that most of us actually have to worry about, because you and I are never going to have to save the galaxy, probably. I mean, I would assume. And so those stories aren't relatable. They're not tangible. They're not something you where you can put yourself in those shoes. So I'm very intentionally telling very real small stories in a very big setting in a hope that the reader will then be able to connect to this idea that, hey, this is a future you could be into. You don't have to be able to use a lightsaber. You don't have to be a secret princess. Space is also for you.
Seems like people respond to that.
I think so.
I have a bunch of questions about the other species. And I guess one set starts with the sort of growing hard science understanding that we probably can't leave Earth. Mm-hmm. Kim Stanley Robinson's latest talks about this. He talks about a failed effort to colonize a nearby planet, and really underscores in the telling of that tale how embedded we are in terrestrial biology, and how, in a really important sense, it's not at all clear that we could be human without Earth to make us human. And yet we tell these stories mm-hmm. of, you know, sort of taking ourselves away from all of this. And in your stories, one of the ways we see a lot of otherness is, of course, in alien species, other species. And one of the things that's really kind of remarkable for me is that, by contrast to all those other space operas, humans are not the automatic dominant. We're kind of, you know, well, you do some stuff, not necessarily the best at any of it. You know, we're sort of a semi-capable species that is accepted as reasonably intelligent. Anyway, are you thinking about colonialism when you write like that?
Oh, totally. Okay. Absolutely. I think space opera, you know, and again, I say this out of love, but it is deeply embedded with colonialism and Manifest Destiny and all of these things. This idea of just the fact that we talk about space colonies, right? Let's go out and conquer space. Exactly. The language we use around that, I think, is very arrogant and very misguided. And it's the sort of thinking that's caused so many problems here on our own planet. This idea that we have complete dominion over everything here. We're not just one little piece of this larger web. And I grew up on Carl Sagan and that whole idea of us being simultaneously wonderfully special and completely insignificant. And I think that that is a mindset we badly need to adopt if we're going to continue on as a species. And so that's something I wanted to communicate very strongly in these books, is that the only reason humanity has survived is that we had to eat an enormous piece of humble pie. We had to acknowledge that we screwed up big time, and we're now having to kind of go out there and ask the rest of the galaxy for help and acceptance. Right. And that the galaxy kind of has mixed feelings about that, because we're not bringing a ton to the table, you know.
Right. Oh, look, refugees.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Humans start out within the Galactic Commons, which is the main setting, as refugees. And so to me, that's just a reflection of my own values about how we need to, acknowledging the fact that we're not the end-all be-all of existence in the universe doesn't make us any less important. It's just a recontextualizing that I think we could really do with.
Seems like you could say the same thing with a few different words about our place in this system.
Yeah. there may be a metaphor in there. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't want to dominate this whole thing. You guys can jump in.
I mean, you're the science fiction guy.
Okay.
I could ask questions about World War One or the Civil War, but that's why I read about it.
Okay. One of the questions I've always been fascinated with, you write books about, as we said, a post-apocalyptic human species. We've left the planet because it's poisoned, broken, can't support us anymore. So we live either in alien cities on mm-hmm. alien worlds, or in what, in my mind, are a bunch of sort of taped together buckets of, you know, old spaceships.
Yeah.
And there's, as I said, not really room for a whole lot else. We were refugees, so, you know, we didn't take the rest of the species with us. They're just memories. On the other hand, there's all these aliens.
Right.
And it feels like some of the relationships we have with animals, natural world, kind of gets mapped onto aliens.
I mean, I think whenever I go about creating an alien species and an alien culture, I'm always starting from a place of biology, right? Like, I always start there. I am a big animal lover, and I, you know, I'm always obsessed about one thing or another. This week it might be cephalopods. Next week it might be owls. Who knows? So I always sort of take whatever trait I'm most interested in at the moment and then expand on that. For example, Andrisks, one of the major species in the books, you know, you start with something very, that seems very simple, such as being cold-blooded or laying eggs. We'll go with laying eggs. Okay, so they lay eggs instead of giving live birth. How does that change their concept of motherhood? How does that change their concept of family? How does that change their architecture? Honestly, you know, how does it change the way they build their homes and their schools? And you see, it just, you can expand and exponentially from just like one little thing. Same with cold-bloodedness. There's constant fights in the first book about like the temperature on the ship because the mammalian and the reptilian species have very different opinions on that front. So yeah, I'm always just riffing off of Mother Nature, honestly, because real life comes up with far weirder and more wonderful combinations than I ever could on my own.
Right. The platypus.
No one could. You know, if I were to write the platypus, my editor would come back and say, "No, I'm sorry, that's
too impossible.
Too far.
That's
ridiculous.
Too far."
Yeah.
Welcome to the Eco News Report. Talking with local science fiction author extraordinaire Becky Chambers.
Another theme that persists with me through your books and echoes in my own life is this question of culture. And as an environmentalist, a lot of our work is very practical, definite. We want to change this project. We want to open up this area. We want to restore these species. But there's this larger set of questions about how we live in the world. And we don't get to talk about them very much, but it really feels to me like you go there, especially in the last book, by which I mean Record of a Spaceborne Few, not your most recent, to be taught if fortunate. You think about culture and this sort of post-apocalyptic taboos and practices that inform a culture that's kind of been forced to become sustainable.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Spaceborne Few, you know, I think stands out a bit from the other books in the series in that it is solely focused on one culture. In this case, the humans who are still living aboard, as you put it, the taped together buckety spaceships, right? And you know, within the history of the setting, you know, these were the ships that carried the human refugees from Earth, and there were hundreds of years before they actually made contact with alien species. So at that time, they're completely on their own. They have no resources coming in from elsewhere. And I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, sort of reverse engineering that and being like, okay, so I know by the time these books start, humans made it and we're okay. So how did we do that? How did we maintain, you know, not just our physical health, but how did we maintain cultural cohesion for that long in those cramped quarters? And so I just had to think a lot about what are the most humane systems you could have? What are the most sustainable systems you could have? And so I spent a lot of time researching things about recycling and composting and permaculture systems and all of these things that you don't necessarily associate with spaceships, but I think would be absolutely relevant within a context of you can't pull over to the nearest 7-Eleven and get something else because there's nothing else out there. You can't, and these people don't have the technology to, you know, mine asteroids or anything like that. Everything has to be reused. Everything has to be repurposed. There cannot be waste in these environments.
One of your main characters' job is to compost people.
That's right. That's right. In the Exodus fleet, which is the ships we're talking about, the practice is to compost the dead. And this is a very sacred ritual, and her job is not something taboo. She's very, very well respected in her community for doing this. There's no secret about it. Some people may use like the compost of a loved one on their own personal food gardens at home and stuff. They have this very visceral connection with life and death and reuse. But all of that is born out of real world ideas. Human composting is something that is being developed in the here and now.
I was just going to say, I was in the news last week.
Well, it was wonderful about that. So there's an effort up in Washington that's being led by a woman named Katrina Spade, who has been working for many years on developing, you know, like an urban scale human composting systems. I don't know her personally, but she was kind enough to chat with me while I was doing my research for Spaceborne. Oh, sweet.
Okay.
Yeah, I hopped on the phone with her and picked her brain about, learned about things like carbon and nitrogen ratios and all that sort of stuff. So all of my work, even though it's far future and I do take a lot of liberties, I am always trying to ground it in real science and you know, real environmental work that is going on here.
But it sounds like what you're trying to do is capture a story where we've gone through a profound bottleneck, mm-hmm. you know, a set of really tight constraints, and yet made the best choices, the most humane choices to get through it. Obviously, we could have a really different set of choices that the dystopian stories tell those. Yeah,
but I think that's the key thing, though, right? Is that it is a choice.
Right.
And everything we do right now, right here now, the choices that are before us are immense and incredibly important. And it's easy when we, you know, when we look at the depressing headlines we mentioned to just see it as a foregone conclusion, but it's absolutely not. We have a choice. We can turn this around. We just have to have the willpower to do it. And I think going back to the strength of optimism, when you're talking about the future, that's why it's so important to have optimistic science fiction and to have futures you can point to and say, well, what if we could do something like this instead? It makes it easier to make those sorts of choices if you know what you're aiming for.
What does living here bring to your work, if anything?
That's a wonderful question. No, so much. Sense of community, hugely. I grew up in Los Angeles and I bounced around a lot after that, but I was often in big cities. This is the smallest and sort of most intimate community I've ever been part of. And Spaceborne Few is the one of the series that I wrote here. And I think it's so different because of that, because I, for the first time, was in a place where you could really feel that sense of interconnectedness and where there's so many groups like people like yourselves or the city's zero waste efforts or, you know, all these amazing grassroots groups that we have here that are working so hard to bring about positive change. Not to say that those things don't exist elsewhere, but it's here in a much more tangible way than I've experienced elsewhere. And I think also just the proximity to nature. As mentioned, the biological world is such an inspiration for me anyway. Just being able to have easier access to the great outdoors and to go out and just sit and watch banana slugs for a few hours or what have you is a great source of creative fuel for me.
I figured it'd be nudibranchs, but yeah.
Oh, I love them too. Yeah. Anything squishy is, yeah, I'm a big fan.
Tom's looking at his phone, which reminds me how often I'm looking at my phone all the time.
Yep.
And just I'm
a Wi-Fi in space, I assume.
Well, you know, the thing for me is I've spent my entire life being easily distracted boy. You know, I read the back of the cereal carton when I was a kid. I'd read anything in sight just because that's the way my brain works. But as I was reading around on the internet, trying to figure out where you were coming from, Becky, I ran across you talking about the value of boredom. And, you know, it's something that's harder to find these days.
It is, yes.
And what are we losing? And what are we gaining?
Yeah, I think that I hate being bored, but at the same time, it's one of the most useful things I do every day. When I sit down to write, you know, my phone doesn't come into my office with me.
That's how you do it.
That's the key. But it is part of it where I sit there, you know, and at first there's a million other things I think I want to do, and I just let myself get bored. And what happens after the initial discomfort of, oh, I'm bored, is you start telling yourself stories. Your brain starts filling in the gaps. A ton of the world building for all of my books happened on buses and in airports and on trains, you know, places where you're stuck and have nothing to do and probably don't have Wi-Fi. It's really important to just let yourself be sometimes and not let everybody else who wants to distract you. And those are the moments where you really start to form connections and start to piece things together in ways that you haven't done before. And, you know, you asked, what is it that living here brings me? It is easier for me to avoid distraction here, I feel, you know, if I'm starting to get bogged down in, you know, all the million little things that are picking at my brain, I can just go for a walk in the community forest and just wander around for a few hours and let myself be quiet. And I think it is definitely harder to find these days, but it's still there if you want it. It's hard for me too to put my phone down, but there's a lot of value in it for sure.
So when you're going forward and thinking about your next book, are you thinking about what is the sort of issue I want to tackle or the set of concerns I want to bring up in this book? Or is it you have a story or a character in mind that you want to explore further?
It's a little bit of both. I generally am working with characters first because all of these stories are fairly small scale. I like to start with the nitty gritty. I write very seat of my pants. I don't outline, and I rarely am like, here is the message of this story. Like I do like to keep it subtle, but I often do have sort of themes I want to play with or broad questions I want to address. And so those are often things I'll write down at the beginning just to sort of have in the back of my head. But once I get into actually writing it, I'm focusing largely on the characters and sort of letting them answer those questions and express those things as I go along, rather than trying to mold them into enacting the sort of passion play that I want to, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So you're working on books now, I take it?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Can you give us a preview of what's to come?
Sure, as much as I can say at the moment. But yeah, I have one more Wayfarers book on the way, which should be out I have to finish it, but yay. It should be out in early next year. The title hasn't been announced yet, so stay tuned on that. I have a pair of novellas that'll be coming out from Tor.com. They're solar punk, not space opera. So that's been a really fun departure from my usual sandbox. So a bit of a different flavor there.
Can you define solar punk?
Solar punk is, all right, so you know cyberpunk, the high tech.
Our audience might not.
Okay. Yeah. So cyberpunk being the high tech dystopian future that I think we're kind of living in already, but... Right. You know, solar punk is the polar opposite of that, in which you have a huge focus on green sustainable technology. You have technology that is balanced with nature and actually and works in concert with nature. And it is if not purely utopian, at least a much more egalitarian future, generally a balanced, sustainable future rather than something out of whack where technology is working against us, is something where we've managed to use it as a source of good.
Kim Stanley Robinson wrote a series called Three Californians, mm-hmm. and I think one of them would be solar punk.
I think it would fit the bill, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a few books or authors you'd recommend people check out other than your own?
Oh, okay, sure.
Stuff makes your brain light up.
One of the best things I've read recently is a novella called This Is How You Lose the Time War, which is extremely difficult to explain. But if you like poetic, super weird, super beautiful science fiction, I would highly recommend it. If you're into space opera, my friend Yoon-Ha Lee's books, Nine Fox Gambit is the first of his series. It'll wreck your brain in the best possible way. And if you'd like something a little closer to home, Mary Robinette Cowell's Lady Astronaut series, the first of which is The Calculating Stars, something I would very much recommend.
Excellent. Those are all things I haven't read and things that have gotten a lot of good notice recently.
They're really excellent work. I think I'm biased, of course. But yeah, you can't really go wrong with any of those.
And then looking backwards, who are a few authors who really shaped how you read, how you see, how you feel about science fiction and the kind of work you do?
The big one for me is Ursula K. Le Guin. You know, I grew up loving Star Trek and Star Wars, and I still do. And, you know, I was a big fan of science fiction sort of on the screen. Right. But when I first read Le Guin in my teens, it was this watershed moment for me. It was, oh my God, this is something I've never seen before. This is what you could do with science fiction. It just changed me profoundly. It made me want to write it myself. Her work is still just second to none. And it had a huge influence on me in that it taught me that you can tell stories that are about things other than, you know, exploding spaceships and planets blowing up, even though I love that stuff. But you could do so much more than that. Beyond Her, not science fiction, but again, Carl Sagan Contact actually was my introduction to his work. So I guess it does start with science fiction.
Right.
But after I saw that and went through a period of being 12 years old and wanting to grow up being Jodie Foster in the movie, you know, I went and read Pale Blue Dot and Cosmos and all of it. And that profoundly shaped not just my writing style, my creative influences, but also just my worldview in general. And then other favorites beyond that, Margaret Atwood and Octavia Butler are big ones for me as well.
For pretty obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Really appreciate your work and your time today.
It's been a real pleasure being here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Becky. Is there a spot that we want to direct people to buy your books? Do you have a retailer that you like?
My books are available at Northtown Books and at Tin Can Mailman, but you can get them anywhere books are sold. If they don't have them in stock, they'll be able to get them for you.
Okay. And that's a good reminder to shop local. All right. So thank you, Becky. Again, The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, A Closed and Common Orbit, Record of a Spaceborne Few, and To Be Taught If Fortunate. Go out and buy them today. I know that Scott can't recommend them more highly.
That's true.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Eco News Report.